Place for Film, the official IU Cinema podcast. My name is David Carter, and I hope all of you have been holding up well in the first 2 weeks of the new year. I know I have just been trying to catch up on things from the previous year and watch through all the lovely gifts to myself and from others and kind of ease into the grind of everything, you know, coming back in full force after the holiday. Yeah, been a cool couple of weeks. I've gotten to check out some things that I got to miss from 2021. I got to finally see Worst Person in the World, which swept me off my feet. And I really do enjoy a movie that is a coming-of-age story, but for adults, when you've already come of age, but, you know, you have more development to do because growing in life never stops. And then I've got to go down to Indy, as I kind of mentioned later in this episode, to see Licorice Pizza with some friends, and my heart swoons. That movie is a little miracle, reminds me of why I love movies so much. Maybe I'll talk about it in depth someday on this podcast, but yeah, Licorice Pizza is great stuff, and I really hope all of you get a chance to watch it when it comes out on VOD or streaming, or you buy the Blu-ray. Yeah, that is, like every PTA movie when it comes out, it's my favorite PTA movie. It's the last one I saw. So, also, been catching up on some Shaw Brothers movies. If you follow my physical media part of this podcast, I didn't review the Arrow Shaw Brothers Volume 1 box set. I actually spent my own money on it, and so I've been very just casually watching through them. I've watched 11 out of the 12 films in the box set. I actually just finished Heroes of the East last night, and God, talk about a movie that's structured so interestingly. Like, the first half of it being this, like, culture clash movie and kind of propagandistic kind of display of, like, Chinese prowess and martial arts and how, you know, it's superior to Japan and, like, all this other stuff. But then the last 45 minutes of it are just straight up a tournament movie in which it's just nonstop action from the time he starts fighting somebody till the very end of the movie. It's crazy. Crippled Avengers has one of the craziest finales to a martial arts movie I've seen in a long time. With a lot of great, very dexterous ring work. I'll leave that for you to watch on your own if you haven't seen it. It's been a good couple of weeks of movie watching, so I hope you guys have been doing the same. As it says in the title description, I have Dr. Alicia Cosma and Brittany Friesen on this episode to kind of talk about, you know, in quotes, the state of art house cinema, international cinema, the film festival circuit, the industry. It's a kind of a loose conversation about just how things like Sundance works and the pipeline to the theaters and how it's sold to audiences and where we are now in the pandemic with it. So that's a great conversation. Brittany and Dr. Cosma are experts in that field. Brittany was a volunteer at Sundance for over a decade. It's crazy pedigree. But before we get to that, we have to get to the upcoming schedule at the IU Center. This week at the IU Cinema, on Tuesday, January 18th at 7 p.m., we have our first film of the semester's President's Choice series, which is going to be Iphigenia. The President's Choice series is a series that which allows IU Chancellor, former President Michael McGrabie, choose a series of films to program during the semester. This year's theme, he has decided to program the Greek trilogy of films by Michael Kakoyannis, adapted from the Euphrates, the Enduring Trilogy, which includes Iphigenia, The Trojan Women, and Electra. These are films that combine elements and cinematic styles from both the European art house and Hollywood filmmaking traditions. Kakoyannis' films remind us of the continued immediacy and relevance of these ancient tragic tales. Yes, and the first film in this series is going to be Iphigenia, which is story about a girl who is the daughter of Agamemnon in Clytemnestra, who was ordered to be sacrificed to the goddess Artemis as recompense for an offense done to her by Agamemnon's father. Agamemnon is preparing to command an army against Troy, but his assault is stymied by the gods until the sacrifice is carried out. Forced to comply to serve his men and his country, Agamemnon sends Iphigenia to her fate under the pretext of marriage. However, second thoughts send him on a race against time to undo his deceit, but only if fate will allow. Iphigenia was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film in the Palme d'Or at the 1977 Cannes Film Festival. It is in Greek with subtitles. It does contain violence against animals. As someone who is a big fan of Greek mythology, I'm very much looking forward to seeing this. I'm actually not as well versed in Greek literature as I would like to be, so this is something I'm looking forward to seeing. Once again, this is Tuesday, January 18th. It is $4, and as with all the screenings I will mention on the schedule, just please note, masks are required for all attendees in the cinema staff at indoor events. Due to our limited screening schedule and currently reduced seating capacity, we strongly encourage patrons to buy tickets online in advance to avoid getting sold out, and there will be no standby line or late seating. So once again, that is Tuesday, January 18th at 7 o'clock. It is $4. The next film we have is Tron Legacy. This is Thursday, January 20th at 7 p.m., also $4. This is part of our Staff Select series, which I am now a proud member of later in the semester. You'll hear more about that as I annoyingly plug Speed Racer and why you should come out to it and reevaluate that movie if you didn't like it when you saw it all the way back in 2008. But this is my good friend and IU Cinema house manager Ava Clowden's pick, a movie that we have talked about a lot together. This is the 2010 film directed by Joseph Kosinski, who this is his debut feature film, despite being a designer by trade, most famous for directing like a Gears of War and Halo 3 commercial back in the mid-aughts. This is the follow-up to the 1982 cult hit Tron, starring Jeff Bridges. If you remember that movie, that was about a program and video game designer getting transported into a digital world where he has to do gladiatorial combat with computer programs. As you can probably guess, I'm a big fan of that type of narrative in a film, being a fan of The Matrix. But this is the follow-up that is so well designed, has an incredible soundtrack by Daft Punk, which has its own crazy legacy behind it. But yes, it is the follow-up starring Garrett Hedlund, one of the kind of many bland white guys we tried to make stars in like the early 2010s and late aughts, and I guess still to this day. But yes, he's looking for his father, Kevin Flynn, played by Jeff Bridges, and he gets zapped into the world of Tron himself, looking for his father. And from there, there's an evolution of the world Tron introduced in 1982, a fleshing out. Computer programs are evolving. And this is just a good time at the movies in which you are immersed by incredible images and a wall of sound from Daft Punk, who are drawing influence from people like John Carpenter and Wendy Carlos. It doesn't, except for a few spots, it doesn't sound like anything you would assume Daft Punk would make for a film score, but it is excellent. So you can attend that on Thursday, January 20th at 7 p.m. It is $4. I highly recommend it. I'll be there hooting and hollering, and I hope to see you there too. Next up on Friday, January 21st at 7 p.m., we have The Rescue, which is $4 for students and $7 for non-students. This is the 2021 documentary that chronicles the enthralling, against-all-odds story that transfixed the world in 2018. The daring rescue of 12 boys and their coach from deep inside a flooded cave in northern Thailand. Academy Award-winning directors and producers Elizabeth Chai Vasahareli and Jimmy Chin of Free Solo fame keep viewers on the edge of their seats as they use a wealth of never-before-seen material and exclusive interviews to piece together the high-stakes mission, highlighting the efforts of the Royal Navy SEALs and U.S. Air Force Special Tactics, and details the expert cave diver's audacious venture to dive the boys directly to safety. The rescue brings alive one of the most perilous and extraordinary rescues in modern times, shining a light on the high-risk world of cave diving, the astounding courage and compassion of the rescuers, and the shared humanity of the international community that united to save the boys. It's played a lot of places, a lot of acclaim. I'm excited to finally get to see it at the IU Cinema this semester. I've heard that it's just one of those documentaries that kind of gets into the nitty-gritty of a skill and craft that has kind of gone by the wayside and like this very specific group of people who are the last group of people in the world who have the knowledge to execute something like this. So that should be fascinating. And that is Friday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Next up, also on Friday, January 21st at 10 p.m., $4 for everyone, we have Julia DeCarnau's follow-up to her film Raw. This is Titan. This is part of our Not Quite Midnight series. I will read the description as it is on the website, even though I have my own description of this movie. But Titan is centered on the enigmatic, compulsive, and uncontrollable Alexia, played by Agatha Roussel. Titan seemingly traces the aftermath of a series of unexplained crimes in the reunification of Vincent, played by Vincent London, with his son, who's been missing for 10 years. But nothing in Titan is what it seems, as the viewer is thrust into Alexia's world of cyborg bodies, solitary foreboding, fast cars, and ravenous tenderness. We are forced to reconcile with our inability to control the uncontrollable. This was the hot winner of the 2021 Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, only the second woman director to ever win one of cinema's most prestigious prizes. This is in French with subtitles. So you could go off of that description, or you could go off of it as this, my description, which is a movie about transformation and coming into yourself and also sex with cars. And that's all I'll say about the movie. I love this movie. This is one of my top 10 favorite films of 2021. You have to come and see this movie. I can guarantee that if you are a fan of things like David Cronenberg's Crash, you will enjoy Titan. I think Julia DeCarnau is one of our most exciting directors working today. And so it should be a treat to come and see this at the IU Cinema. So once again, that is $4 for everybody. And our last screening is just a replay screening on Sunday, January 23rd at 1 o'clock. It is The Rescue once again. So that is going to do it for the IU Cinema schedule. I will now turn it over to past David Carter and Dr. Alicia Cosma and Brittany Friesner as we talk about the current state of international art house cinema.
I'm Brittany Friesner. I am the Associate Director for IU Cinema. I've also volunteered and worked for multiple film festivals, Sundance, Seattle, Tribeca, et cetera, in programming, marketing, development, a little bit of everything.
I am Dr. Alicia Cosma. I am the director of IU Cinema, and I go to various festivals as well as think about the kind of industry function of festivals as a whole as it relates to distribution, theatrical exhibition, non-theatrical exhibition, pandemic exhibition, and all that fun stuff.
Thank you both of you for being on this episode. It's nice to finally have you on the podcast, Alicia.
I'm so excited. Thank you.
And we got you in way quicker than the last director who it literally took me until he wasn't director anymore to get him on the podcast.
Now I feel very special.
Thank you so much for coming. As I probably said before, as I recorded the introduction to this episode by myself, this is an episode that is intended to highlight the International Art House series at the IU Cinema this semester. And I thought a fun way to do that would to be have a very serious discussion about the state. No, not serious, but a discussion on the state of international film, art house film. This is also coming on the, well, not heels, because Sundance starts January 20th, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So by the time this goes up, this will be out before that. So yes, you two will be attending Sundance. This is coming out kind of in conjunction with Sundance and film festival season kicking off. And, you know, those being where all the deals are made for international and art house films, where we get all the like buzz for something and then forget about it until November and are like, oh yeah, that did play at Sundance in January. I should check that out. I just kind of wanted to talk to you both about your personal history with the, be it the film festival circuit or programming international and art house films and your relationship with that sector of cinema. You know, all of us are, I would say we all kind of lean towards populist cinema, given our, I wouldn't say any of us are very erudite about the way we talk about cinema.
Oh, Alicia and I just got done talking about our Fast and the Furious marathon we're going to do someday soon.
Literally my Letterboxd like year in review, my most watched actor was Vin Diesel, because I watched all the Fast and the Furious movies.
And F9 was one of my top rated films, but yeah.
So, to this day, I still have past students of mine that email me and say, Alicia, I just told someone why Fast and the Furious is actually the best representation of global cinema as a franchise. They didn't believe me, but then I told them what we learned in contemporary film and television. I was like, listen, man, I told you. You want to understand the globalization of world cinema? You need to understand the family.
I mean, it's largely true. I mean, Fast and Furious have more in common with what comes out of like East and South Asia than which are the biggest, you know, whether Hollywood likes to admit it or not, are the biggest films in the world currently that don't have Spider-Man in them. But yeah, like Fast and Furious models pretty much is like the international blockbuster model.
It is. And it's also the actual model for what inclusive crewing looks like, what inclusive casting looks like, all these things that Hollywood likes to talk about is like the stuff we'll get to one day. Well, you know what, everybody, Fast and Furious already got to it. Welcome to my TED talk on the Fast and Furious franchise.
I can't wait till there's an off week in 2023 or 2024 whenever the part one of the 10 film series comes out, where I can just have both of you on again. I can loop back around to this. Who knows? Maybe we can get Vin on for it.
It's like a full Fast and Furious conference. The whole thing.
Hey, you should pitch it to IU. They had a John Wick conference like it was three. Yeah, it was like one of the last
that we were just pandemic. Talking about that earlier too.
Yeah, I mean that was. I mean, when I found that out, I was like, maybe this Matrix conference could happen. But then, you know, the world happens, so whatever. Yeah, so Brittany, I'll start with you because you have such a, like, I know kind of your background with Sundance and obviously as a programmer and all that stuff, but just for the audience, like, how did you get involved with Sundance? And then how do you feel about, as a programmer, about International Art House Film and the programming of it at the IU Cinema over the your tenure there?
Well, I'd actually go back before Sundance in terms of what got me interested in film, and it was living in Seattle and the Seattle International Film Festival, which takes place there every May, June, which literally takes over the city. It's like 5 weeks. I think it's the longest running film festival in the world. Most are 10 days. I was living in Seattle 2000 to 2005, and in 2004, I became a member of SIFF and realized that people got paid to watch movies and tell other people to watch them. So that's really what started me down the road of, oh, I think I could do this for a living someday. Moved back to Bloomington, got involved with Pride Film Festival here, managing the volunteer programming committee, and then saw actually someone that I became friends with later wrote an article for The Writer magazine about his experience volunteering at Sundance. I kind of knew this person already, and I was like, well, you know, if he can do it, I could do it. Applied the first year. I didn't know anything, and I'm surprised I ever went back. Didn't bring the right clothes. It was just a terrible year for weather. It was awful. But I was bit, and I came back and kept coming back. I volunteered in theater operations at Sundance from 2008 to 2015. And then I started going just as a programmer because the timing conflicted with Art House Convergence. I got to see, it's interesting, I've been able to see in those years a lot of premieres of filmmakers we later hosted at IU Cinema. So it's been great to be like, I saw Middle of Nowhere premiere at Eccles, Ava, DuVernay. So yeah, that's been interesting to have that journey. From there, before I got the job at IU Cinema, I did more with Tribeca Seattle. Going back to Seattle, decided to go to grad school to actually legitimize my potential to get a job like I got now. And then when I first started the cinema, I wasn't doing a lot of programming. And then John went on sabbatical in 2015, 2016. And that's when I was handed the reins to program International Art House Cinema, as well as a few other series I'd never always had opinions about and would pass things along to John, but wasn't directly involved with booking. So that was my first time realizing how much of our international art house is difficult to fill with international film. You know, I think for a lot of art house cinemas these days, international art house when it includes U.S. films, we tend to be heavy on those as a community, as art house cinema, of wanting to book the, you know, English language speaking films, whether they're from the U.S. or the U.K., and really trying to pull back on that and go, okay, this is international. Yes, we are international to some, but how do we get more populations represented, more community voices engaged in this program? And then at that level, not all French, German, Japanese, all the usual suspects as well. So that's been something I've been trying to do behind the scenes as I've been doing more and more programming, is get more underrepresented countries as well as underrepresented artists, especially something like Haifa Al-Mansour, a woman director from Saudi Arabia, which hopefully is not going to be a novelty moving forward, but really thinking about what international art house cinema can entail beyond the sort of usual suspects has been very important to me. And I think something that is more readily available now, especially with, honestly, with the pandemic. I think a lot of programmers had to dig deeper into festivals beyond the usual suspects to find more things to program, because there wasn't a lot more being released at the start of the pandemic, even with virtual cinema. So it's weirdly a blessing for art house cinema, I feel like, in the past year or so, in some ways, that voices that may have been overlooked at festivals are getting more eyes on them now, and more opportunities to be screened for folks.
And Alicia, I actually don't know your relationship with the international art house film community. You said this is your first year going to Sundance, at least virtually. I didn't know what your festival, international film festival experience was like.
It is. I'll be honest with you. I don't really consider Sundance an international film festival, quite frankly, like at all. The festivals that I've attended in the past tend to be more niche. So, for example, like the True False Documentary Film Festival, which is really one of the, I've seen some of the best films I've ever seen there, particularly for a fest that really interprets documentary like really loosely, and like Berlinale. So like other film festivals that are actually international focused. Sundance to me is, well, contemporary Sundance is not really international, and it's not even particularly super art housey. My relationship with Sundance has been driven by two things. One, you know, I did do some programming at the previous theater that I worked at, but two, in my own like academic research, you know, I focus on industry studies, and particularly I focus on who gets to work in the film industry. Film festivals are a really important measure of what we call the pipeline, right? There's a pretty standard pipeline about who gets to work in top level creative positions in the film industry that goes film school, film fests, submitting labs, which Sundance is a really great like lab incubator, feature or world premiere at a festival, directing a film, right? There's kind of like a pipeline. In the industry, for anyone that is not like a cis white male, that pipeline stops at feature premieres at a film festival. So film festivals are a really important like research site for how work is getting out there, whose work is getting out there, and what are the barriers for once that work is in the world, once that work has been picked up by a distributor and it's out, why now aren't people moving on to like larger studio projects, larger feature projects? So from an academic perspective, Sundance is a microcosm of what's going on in Hollywood, right? It's also, I think, exhibition perspective, it's a really interesting case study of the division, or I should say lack of division, between really what we call art house films and what we call mainstream films. So the history of Sundance, we don't have to get into the whole thing, but the history of Sundance was really as independent film, right? And this like ticks up in the 90s, you get the rise of Indiewood, you're seeing actual independent like distribution companies and independent films, producers, directors, whatever, at Sundance getting their work out there. It won't be a surprise to anybody listening to this podcast, but independent film doesn't really exist anymore in the way that it did in early Sundance. Well, there is now this kind of like neo-DIY indie-like wave that's happening, but that's not Sundance, right? What Sundance is your kind of like mini majors, like A24, Annapurna, like those that are dealing in what we would call kind of less mainstream right? That like liminal space in between true independent and mainstream film.
It's almost like they are the new, like that's as close as we get to like the mid-budget
feature anymore.
Yeah, like there are new Miramax, by, like, right? There are new old Miramax, I should say.
Yeah.
A24 is the new old Miramax.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's fine. Old Miramax, minus the people who ran it, put out really good stuff, right? A24, we can have nicer things to say about the people that run it, but they also put out really good stuff, right? So it's okay. So it's either for those like mini majors or it's for the quote independent arms of studios, right? So your Fox Searchlight, your Sony's Pictures Classics. In that regard, it's really not, and you can even look at the schedule that came out, you know, for this year's festival. You can look at the schedule for any year's festival. It's really not internationally focused. You get a sprinkling of international work thrown in there, which is good, but it's not the place where you really want to be to kind of have your finger on the pulse of what's happening in a global art house community. That being said, it's a really important festival for understanding trends that are coming up in Hollywood, in our mini majors, and in the kind of quote art house or independent arms of studios themselves, right? Also, for nothing else, Sundance is name recognition, right? So there can be, and there have been, some truly just like weird and wild films that sneak in at Sundance that you really want people to see. And saying it was at Sundance or it won X award at Sundance will get people into the theater to see it where something else may have not. So it's really good in that regard. Probably the most beneficial thing about Sundance, which is kind of consistently overlooked, is their Indigenous filmmaking program, as well as the myriad labs that they run on a yearly basis, not just during the festival. But the festival is a festival. Famous people are there. Pretty people are there. Lots of money gets spent. It is a good litmus test for where Hollywood is going. It's not a great litmus test for where audiences might necessarily be going.
I actually wanted to delve into that. How do you, you know, you two, from your perception of working at these venues over the course of the years, like when you are chasing that, whatever is hot at Sundance, whatever's hot at Tribeca or Toronto or South by Southwest, when you're chasing that and you program those things, or even just watching other venues program those things, the things that don't go to an AMC or a Regal, like if those are the hot trends, how do you feel like audiences are like consuming and like reacting to them and like going to them numbers wise or, you know, reaction wise?
I mean, I'll say, first of all, I have been to many a Sundance where I work volunteer and manage the Eccles Center, which is where all the big premieres are. And we do, when it's awards days, we have US Dramatic and Audience Award. And in many, many, many years, those are the same two films. I specifically remember the year Whiplash won everything. We just basically showed it all day for 2 days. That movie did not do anything. There have been many years where something's done great at Sundance, audience-wise or jury-wise, and not gone anywhere. Whether it hasn't been picked up by distribution or we've actually tried to screen it at IU Cinema and our audiences didn't relate. It's really easy to get caught up in the energy of seeing something at Sundance. And then that doesn't maybe translate 6, 7, 8 months down the line. Or the film can't find distribution. And so it's not available for 2 years. And then by then, it's the buzz has died down and everybody forgets that movie. You know, I'll be interested to see how Coda ends up doing, especially because of the pandemic and not being able to be in theaters and people get that experience. And even if it was, it's on Apple TV. It's played very limited theaters. So yeah, I don't think something doing amazing at Sundance or any other film festival means it's going to translate necessarily to your audience. I think you need to really still know your audience and know what's going to hit them and what appeals to them and what they're interested in seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Coda is a great example. You know, there's a lot of like awards buzz around that film right now. Like, go outside on the street and stop 10 people, none of them will have watched Coda.
No one's talking about Coda.
No one's seen it. Nope. And like, it's a very enjoyable film.
Yeah.
It's very easy to watch, easily available on the internet. You can watch it at home, on demand, whatever. Nobody's watching it, right? But that was the big hit that came out of Sundance last year. You know, Apple like came in and bought it for $25 million. And which was a wild price.
I still can't believe that.
Wild price.
Talk about money. Yeah. Wow.
When that happened, I just assumed it was to essentially scare off other people, like for the rest of the family. I had no idea what the logic behind this, because there's no way they were that desperate for prestige programming.
No, and David, I totally agree with you, because one of the things that's so interesting about Sundance, you know, I was talking before about it, tells you where Hollywood's going. It also tells you the kind of messages that Hollywood is trying to send, particularly with price tags like $25 million. I don't know what message $25 million for Coda. I don't know what message that's trying to send. And that movie just didn't hit. Like, it could have been in 100,000 theaters and that movie was just not going to hit. I think about something like Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation just literally the talk of not just the festival that year, but of the entire industry, a huge bidding war. Fox Searchlight, I mean, emptied out the closets to pick up that film. And it was very obvious why. It was right after Oscars So White. You know, it's the Nat Turner Rebellion. It's an African-American man directing it and starring in it. And that movie did no business. Not just in IU Cinema, it did no business across the board. And it did no business before the controversy about the film came out.
I distinctly remember having to explain that to someone. They were just like, oh, is that the movie that disappeared because of Me Too? And I was like, No, that movie disappeared.
It disappeared before it got Me Too'd. Hollywood is not subtle, ever. It was very transparent why there was a bidding war around The Birth of a Nation, right? I think last year, the first virtual fest, now we're going to roll into the second virtual fest next week. I think nobody knew what they were doing. I think Apple TV has a lot of money to burn. And for them, they're working on like a early 2000s HBO strategy.
Yeah.
We need awards now. Yeah, they're working on we want awards now. They're working on we're building prestige and we can pay for it. So we're going to pay for it. And that's fine. But because it is so insular, and you can, for every example of something like the big sick that just hits everywhere, you get a Coda or you get a Birth of a Nation, right? I feel like the things like the Big Sick, or even if we go back way back to like OG Sundance, talking about Sex, Lies, and Videotape, popular hit, critical hit, financial hit, festival hit, and everything hit, much like the Big Sick, right? Those are becoming increasingly rare. And it's increasingly rare because these festivals are really great places to see a bunch of movies at once. Mm-hmm. Like for programmers, it's an economical use of time. For no one in the world except celebrities, is it a financially economical good use of anything because it costs a fortune. But it is an economical use of time for programmers who need to see as much as possible in order to really determine what is of value to bring back to their audiences. But past that, it reminds me of like the Bong Joon-ho quote from Parasite, the local award ceremony. Like, this is a thank you for inviting me to your local award ceremony. It's a local film festival for the industry. It's not super different.
And that's what I was thinking earlier. I was thinking of, you know, the state of art house through the pandemic. Is it's truly, truly unfortunate that I feel like international film was about to have a really great moment after Parasite won the Oscar. And then everything just went dark for a while until we all figured out what we were doing. And I lament that we lost that momentum on a bigger scale than people who are already invested in art house films.
It actually kind of seemed like we were maybe heading into another, like, I wouldn't call it an independent film movement or anything like that, but another sort of like, hey, we're about to open up these new roads to so many different types of films from so many different places because
it's
now
no
we
other
know
reason
that it's possible.
We're going to shame you into reading subtitle films, okay? Like, come on, guys. let's get with it. There's a lot of art you're missing out there because you're afraid to read.
Well, and then, you know, I find that interesting because now there are people who are upset that Ryusuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car won, you know, best non-English language film at the gold, in quotes, Golden Globes.
Quotes.
The tweet.
Or at the Tweet Not Globes.
Yeah. Minari.
Or Minari, yeah. Best yeah. foreign language film. What? Yeah. Come on.
And I just, you know, there are people who are weird about the idea that, like, there are international films, once again, like, kind of crossing over a little bit into, you know, as much as there can be a mainstream public consciousness when it comes to international film. Do you see that pushback happening amongst, like, your most casual, you know, people you would define as, like, casual cinema goers who are attending a rep theater or anything? Like, are there people who are like, I'm just here to see Zola, like whatever the A24 movie is, like, I don't know anything about even like the hot, like, you know, you said you're going out of your way to program less represented cinema from different countries, like, but even something like Drive My Car, Minari, or something like that, where it's like, hey, this is a movie that a lot of people have seen at a lot of different places. Like, do you see pushback from people like them?
I mean, for me, I wouldn't necessarily say pushback. I still think folks aren't willing to take a lot of chances on films that don't have something backing them up. Something that's a quote from someone somewhere or it played somewhere. You know, I purposely tried to program a lot of horror or genre films directed by women from places that are not the United States in the last few years. And the people who come love them. They are not films that anyone takes a chance on. But, for example, our tickets went on sale for this coming season, and no one's taking a chance on anything. The Tragedy of Macbeth is selling the best of our international art house series. So I don't know necessarily if us on a college campus are the best arbiter of what general art house audiences are doing. But it seems like folks who are willing to take a chance are, and again, this might be, you know, more of a marketing thing, but Titan, which I could see also being programmed as an international art house film, but we have programmed as a Not Quite Midnight coming up. It sold the most tickets of any event so far this spring. Now that has a huge, huge buzz behind it. You know, what is leading people to want to see that more than anything is probably that they've heard of it.
Yeah, I'd say there's buzz, there's hype. I think there's also probably the contingent of a generation of filmgoer coming of age. Finally, like, we're kind of starting to see it. Is it, I don't know if you would say it's Gen Z or something else. Like, I don't know, but they're coming of age. And I think there's always going to be that initial push because it happened. Like, I'm a millennial and it happened with me in like the 2010s, like with certain types of films. But like anything that's sort of like transgressive or like has a sort of almost like not anti art house, but just like in your face aesthetic to it is always going to appeal to a crowd of people who, you know, are a little younger and a little bit more willing to take like the risk on something like that. Whereas something that's like a little bit more low key and pleasant, or, you know, not even pleasant, but just something that's like a little less transgressive may not appeal to them as much, even though they'd probably take a chance on it like later.
And,
when they hear
and do you think that's because they won't get to have conversations about it?
Yes, I think that is exactly the case. They won't like the lacking of conversation behind a film can hurt it. And in my opinion, something that's not as readily made for conversation is going to disappear quickly, be it because you don't have like the words to say something about it, or, you know, it's just not your... it's not from your frame of reference, so you're like, it's
or
hard
it was
to like,
just good.
Or it's like just that, good. Yeah, sometimes it's the movie is just good.
It was
good.
Just good.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Whereas like something like Titan, like even if you didn't like it, you'll have an opinion on it.
Yeah. Because it's talk about it, yeah.
Yeah, it'll inspire something strong within you.
I think, David, you're right to think about this kind of like up and coming generation of, you know, art house audiences as something separate, because it's important that we recognize that art house audience doesn't mean a single thing, right? Mm. It's a really heterogeneous group. And depending on what time of day you walk into the cinema, you will see massively different types of, quote, art house audiences, right? There's not really just one type of art house audience. And so good programming and good festivals like Sundance or True False or Fantastic Fest or Berlinale or TIFF or Toronto or whatever, they recognize that, right? But I think if an art house is doing its job, if it is sticking to its like programming vision and its curatorial ethos, someone can say, well, I've never heard of this movie, Titan. I don't know how you pronounce it. Oh, it won an award at Cannes. I don't really know what that award is, but I know what Cannes is. But more importantly, I know that the cinema is showing it, and I know they wouldn't show something that wasn't at least worth my time. I might not like it, I might love it, but I know that it'll be worth my time, right? So any good art house theater is building itself a reputation where anyone, casual or dedicated or David Carter level of fan, can say, regardless of what this is, I trust IU Cinema, and I know that it's going to be at bare minimum worth my time to go.
So then I guess that leads me to the question of, like, because it's the, you know, it's the elephant in the room, like, given how the pandemic has, like, shifted people's, like, viewing habits, you know, to either accept or reject virtual screenings, and then when they do go to the theater, you know, I would say the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's been a lot of online conversation amongst, like, critics and then also avid moviegoers, where they're just, the idea of, like, as morbid as it sounds, what am I willing to risk my life to go see? Mm-hmm. As in, like, film critics right now having to deal with, you know, studios being like, hey, this is only in-person screening. So then you have to ask yourself, like, do I want to get sick to go see Scream 5? Like, I don't, like, my job depends on me going to see it, you know? But if you're just, like, a film goer and it's not your job, it's like, well, I will risk my life to go see Spider-Man 3, Spider-Man 3 2, No Way Home, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. But, you know, something that's a little smaller, like, I guess I'll wait, or, you know, if I am going to go see it in a theater, then, like, it's got to be exact perfect condition. Like, I even kind of encountered this recently where I went to Indy to go see Licorice Pizza, not an international or art house film by any metric. It's a PTA movie. Mm-hmm. But because it wasn't playing in town, but the conversations we had to constantly have during it were just like, well, if we're going to go see this, what's the largest theater we can go see it in? We have to call and ask how well attended it is, because if it's very well attended, as oxymoronic as that is, because in the before times you'd be like, oh, packed crowd, great, gonna be good energy. Now you're like, well, I'd rather see it with zero other people in the theater at this point. So I guess my question is to both of you is just, how do you combat, for people who are moviegoers and even who are IU Cinema or art house moviegoers, like, how does that affect your programming to, like, I guess, are you just aiming at whatever entices people into a theater, or are you just like, I'm just gonna do what I'm doing, I'm gonna show these movies because I think they should be shown, like, we have the leeway to do that? Or, you know, is it always just a balance, like most things are?
I think in the fall when we returned, there was more, what are people going to come back for and what are people going to risk? I think even though things obviously have regressed and are worse now than they were last August, I think this semester, especially because it was Alicia's first being able to program things herself rather than coming into a program that had already been set, but also because we're kind of learning how to navigate the pandemic, we just did what we did. We do what we do and hope people show up. But I think it really depends on the state of the pandemic, what our programming philosophy has been, because I tortured myself over what our very first screening back would be after 10 months. And I wanted to pick something celebratory. I also wanted to pick something that was not by a cisgender white person. So all of that went into, how do we represent our values? How do we represent joyfulness and something that's going to feel celebratory? And how do we program something that we think people are going to want to risk their lives for? Because, yeah, that is the reality right now to some degree.
Yeah, I think Brittany's absolutely right in making the distinction between fall and spring. I think one of the other things that we are really also having to navigate in the spring is that distributors don't really want to do virtual screenings anymore. Like, I think being able to offer hybrid programming, some stuff you can see in theaters, some stuff you can watch at home, whatever, I think it's beneficial for a number of reasons. And I think it's something that actually allows more people to participate in the IU Cinema experience, right, than necessarily can always come to the auditorium, like, on any given day. And that's important. Right? That's an important thing for us to do, is to be reaching out past, like, our physical boundaries as much as we can. It's important to our mission. It's important to just, like, film existing in general. It's important to growing that new generation of cinephiles that you were talking about before, and everything, right? But part of that balancing act is dealing with distributors, because a hurdle has been, as things have gotten better, and even now as things have gotten worse, in terms of the pandemic, distributors really want people back in theaters. And I mean, you can look to Sundance making the switch to virtual at such a late point in the game as really emblematic.
They were holding out. Mm-hmm.
They were holding out. They were holding out for distributors. They were holding out for PR. I mean, they were holding out for economic reasons.
I was going to say probably the economy of Park City.
Park City really wanted in-person Sundance. Like, it was really economic reasons that caused this shift so late. And I mean, there has only been so far one film that has pulled out that does not want to do virtual screenings.
Which I just realized is another foreign language remake of another foreign language film, One Cut of the Dead.
Yeah.
So, one of my personal pet peeves is when some American distributor or studio tries to take a beautifully perfect foreign film and release an American English version. So now I find it interesting that it's happening at a different level.
At a French level? Yeah, for sure. Part of what distinguishes Sundance from something like Cannes, which I think would be fair to call, actually an international film festival, is that Cannes has a dual, for our purposes, we'll say they have a dual mission, right? And it was grown with a dual mission. Like, the point of Cannes was this advance of cosmopolitanism coming from France, but like reaching globally pretty much everywhere but the U.S., right? It was like, we can do this too. We are France. We are the home of cinema. We should be representative of global cinema, not the U.S. But if you think about how Cannes operates, Cannes has a theatrical exhibition requirement. And so Cannes is as focused on people going to theaters to watch films as it is on like the back end industry side of it. In fact, not many films show up to Cannes without distributors. Not many films show up to Cannes not having a release plan to put them out into the world. It's very different than Sundance like that, right? It is much more about promoting a film culture than it is necessarily about promoting a film industry, which is really now, I should say, the Sundance focus now. And so it's really, you can see that difference when you have distributors who really do work with international film have tended to be more open to hybrid or virtual programming than US-based distributors who only work with US, quote, independent or quote, art house film, who tend to be less open to that, right? So it really shifts the landscape in thinking about how we program and what we program, but also, who wants to work with us and who is as interested in promoting film culture while also helping theaters, helping filmmakers, helping distributors, and keeping audiences like safe and healthy at the same time. There were always a lot of variables involved in film programming. It is somewhat disingenuous to say the pandemic is just another one, but 3 years in at this point, it kind of is just another one.
Well, for the last thing I'd like to talk about is just something a little lighter, just because we all like movies, is what are you looking forward to from this, this kind of an honor of we're all going to the World's Fair, this movie I've been wanting to watch for a long time that did play at Sundance in 2021, finally found distribution coming out and everything. So, like, what are you looking forward to in this film festival season to seeing either things you've heard about or even not even specific films or filmmakers? It could even just be like trends or types of films or, just seeing what the shifts have been like. What are you most excited about going into this part of the year?
For me, for the last couple of years, even before the pandemic, but certainly now, I'm really been a lot more into genre films and it's specifically indigenous horror. And Berlin last year was great for that. There are a few options this year at Sundance. But what I've found in terms of the shift to virtual attendance at film festivals, as I was talking earlier, a lot of programmers have been, at least early in the pandemic, forced to dive deeper into the deep cuts of previous festivals to find films. I find that sitting at home in my pajamas, participating in virtual Sundance, virtual Berlin, I've seen twice as many movies as I can when I'm shuttling through venues, and I am way more likely to take a chance on something. And, kind of unfortunately, most of my favorite movies that I saw last year at Sundance or SIFF or Berlin or TIFF don't have distribution because they are so small. And I still hope that we can screen them someday. But that's the stuff I've, when I volunteer at Sundance, I'm always at Eccles, which means it's usually easiest for me to see all the things that already have distribution or that are, you know, these big ticket items that's why they're playing at Eccles, because they need a 1300 seat venue to accommodate the demand. So it's been fun for me to attend a lot of festivals virtually, because I'm just able to dig more into world cinema and into the things I didn't feel like I had the opportunity to take a chance on before. So I'm excited about the fact that last year I saw 38 films at virtual Sundance, and my record for any in-person Sundance was 21. And that was working 8.5 hours a day, and I was a much younger person and staying up till 3 in the morning.
Virtual Sundance, for a lot of reasons, I think is a really good thing. Certainly, as Brittany said, you get to watch more than you normally could. At least personally, I get to stand up and watch some things, because there's just only so much sitting one human being should do. So I have like one day where I have like 6 films lined up back to back, and I was like, I will be standing for at least 3 of these, which is very awkward to do in a theater when you're at a festival. So the availability of content is really nice. One of the things that I like, not to throw shade at Sundance, it does do this a little bit, but not as much as some others. There is always some content that will premiere at film festivals that is just ferocious in terms of the issues it's tackling and how it's choosing to do that. More often than not, I found those are documentaries who just do not care who they are going to offend, if they are going to get in trouble, but you need to know this thing. And you know what? We really do usually need to know that thing, need to know about the issue that they are talking about. There looks to be a couple of those at Sundance that I'm really excited for. Unfortunately, those are the types of films that like CNN Films will pick up and run once at like 10 o'clock and then like dump and bury on their website, and you can never watch them again. That's really specific, because I'm thinking of this phenomenal documentary film that I saw, True False, called The Prison in 12 Landscapes, and that is exactly what happened to it. It is one of the most intense and necessary films that I've seen at a festival. CNN Films purchased, they distributed it. They showed it once at like 10 o'clock. You can read about it on their website. There's no way to find this film to watch it. No easy legal way. And let me tell you something. Sweet. Even the illegal way was not easy. So if festivals give you a chance for a chance to do that, there was this, which is another fantastic example, this film called Our New President, which is a look at the U.S. 2020 election, but only as a giant, essentially montage sequence of Russian news and YouTube videos.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. It's phenomenal. But I was dying to show that film in a class that I was teaching, a film theory class, a couple years ago. And boy, did it take me ages to find it. Ages to find it. And actually just like buy the DVD. And that's like now one of my most prized possessions. And I did have to have a friend buy it in Spain from Amazon Spain and ship it to me from Barcelona. Because that was the only way to access it.
Yeah, I've definitely shifted my early in my film festival going days, especially Sundance. You know, we all want street cred. We all love to be smug and be like, oh, I saw that in Park City or wherever. But now I try to see the things I'm never going to see again. There's a really great, it's like, I describe it as Russian Armageddon, but they're firefighters instead of drillers. I think it's just called Fire. I finally found it. You can only find it with an English dub. And it's terrible. It's terrible. It needs to be in the original language. So that is definitely something that I have come to appreciate more with films, film festivals especially, that offer more international fare, is digging out those films I know I might not ever see again. I'll still, you know, there's a Sinead O'Connor documentary at Sundance. You bet your ass I'm going to try to see that. There are some things that I know they're going to come out eventually. I did read an article coming into this recording that a fifth of the films screening at Sundance already have distribution. So, you know, a lot of films, they have their own distinct personalities. As you said, you know, Sundance sort of kicks off the year. TIFF kind of kicks off the awards buzz. So I think that definitely heavily influences what they program.
Yeah.
I mean, the great thing about it being virtual is anyone can get a ticket and go. You know, they're selling single tickets. And so I would, you know, people should find that weird stuff, you know, find that.
Yeah.
There's like a Boeing documentary out there that looks truly maddening and awesome. There is all kinds of stuff in this festival lineup, but you have to go looking for it unless you just want to watch the big hits that they have to, which is fine. Those are also fine. I'm going to watch those too. You know what I mean? But like,
I mean, I 100% agree with you. That I would say is that when I programmed for Heartland in 2021, like that was my biggest mission, was just like, I just want to try to program a few things that I would have to convince people to go see because they would kick themselves otherwise for missing it. I think there is value if you are just a person who's going to a film festival virtually or in person or what have you. There is a lot of value in not watching the things that will get a release within months of you having seen it before everybody else. I can guarantee you, especially given the times that we live in right now, I guarantee you it won't be this like, you won't see the newest David Lynch movie at a film festival with him in attendance and this rapturous applause. Like, this isn't him screening Twin Peaks: The Return at Cannes anymore. Like, that's not really as much of a thing. Like, I programmed a film called Knock Knock by Zhang Liu, a film that has no distribution. It's just a tense one-room thriller from China. It's kind of strange. And
I watched it. It was good.
Yeah. And I was like specifically put that there because I was like, look, I know everyone's going to want to go see Power the Dog or Come On, Come On or whatever. I was like, I just want this there for the people who are like, I'll see it on Netflix or Amazon or whatever in a few months. Like, I want to try to see things like that or at a film festival that I would otherwise not see. So try to take a chance on those things.
In terms of how that influenced directly, that sort of philosophy influenced certainly our art house picks this spring is, look, we need some bangers. We need some things that we know are going to get people out, but let's also take some chances. So it is a fine balance to walk. That is something definitely we think about too in our international art house. And, you know, there are some things we can't screen, like Power of the Dog, because Netflix only permits so many screenings. But that is certainly part of why we picked, say, The Tragedy of Macbeth. And so far that's playing out. But the other film in our art house series that's selling well right now is Lamb, the Icelandic film. So it really is a balance. And going back to what Alicia said earlier, there is no one art house audience or one art house film that kind of represent things. But, you know, Parasite did a pretty good damn job of being a crossover. Yeah. So they can't all be Parasite, but that's what we hope for.
But I'd say if we can get back to wherever we were before, some version of it, it's like I feel like Parasite brought in a whole audience of moviegoers that didn't exist anymore. It might not be like hundreds of millions of new moviegoers, but like it definitely, like, I saw an uptick in interest from people who I would have classified as like very casual, like I go to see a movie once a month maybe type people who are like, hey, I watched a couple of movies this week, like, you want to talk about them? Like, I've seen that and like, you know, not just watching like whatever got recommended to them on Netflix, like legitimately seeking out things. So I would say having things, programming things like Tragedy of Macbeth, you know, props up people's interest in the other things in the program, because they'll be like, well, that was good. Maybe I should check out something else that's kind of like this.
Our hope. So thank you for, everybody listening out there, please take some chances on things other than Tragedy of Macbeth this semester, please.
Like, you can be real well-rounded and watch The Tragedy of Macbeth and
Crypto Zoo
and New York Ninja and really understand cycles of revenge. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I will say this is our time. Technically, I kept you guys for as long as you permitted me to. So I don't know if you want to plug anything. They already know where you are and where to find you. Mm-hmm. But if there's something outside of yourself you want to plug, please feel free. But otherwise,
No, I would just, like I just said, I would challenge everyone listening to please take a chance if you feel safe on at least one film that maybe you've heard nothing about this semester that's in our program. And, you know, honestly, whether it's in person or virtual, we do have, I'd say a fifth of our program is virtual this semester. So the majority is in the cinema, reduced capacity. So buy your tickets early. But yeah, that would be my, please take a chance.
Alicia?
I mean, I co-sign what Brittany said, and I will just say I mean, just trust us, honestly.
Just trust us.
I
didn't. I didn't do any programming, but just trust us at the IU Cinema.
Just trust us. I'll say this, podcast listeners: if we didn't think that David Carter would want to watch it, we probably wouldn't be playing.
And I guarantee you, if I can make it, I'll be at pretty much everything that got programmed this semester because all of it's good.
Yeah,
and so, you'll be introducing some of them.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I don't know what value my word has, but if you listen to this podcast, I guess it has some value.
Yeah. So, oh, also, I'll say this. Just trust us, and you know what? It can't hurt. It's $7.
Yeah, can't hurt.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Can't hurt.
This isn't a $13 movie ticket.
And even though I'm not a proponent of this, if you don't like something, you can just leave. I'm not a proponent of walking out of something before it's over, but
listen,
you know.
I've only ever done it once and I do not regret it. And mm-hmm. you know, make yeah. you can have it.
But
I mean,
just take a chance. But thank you so much for being on here
thank
today.
Thank you, David. Very happy.
Thank you for having us.
And who knows, maybe if time can work out, we'll get that post or during Sundance update
later episode.
Oh yeah.
So maybe keep tuned to that, everybody.
We'll have some opinions, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely.
No.
Oh, do you two opinionated? I haven't been in meetings with you at all. But
strong vision.
Strong vision. Yes, absolutely. But I will say this has been A Place for Film, and we'll see you at the movies. Good night.